Welcome to the Book Show, broadcasting coast to coast. I'm Alex Papajohn.
And I'm Jack Singer.
This is Cutting Edge Talk about cutting edge books. We're broadcasting high atop the Westwood Building in Richmond, Virginia. And this morning we are going to be talking to Michael Graham, author, stand-up comic, radio talk show host, and all-around good guy. And he's going to be talking about a best-selling book, or at least it was a best-selling book several weeks ago, called Redneck Nation, How the South Really Won the War. And I'm telling you, folks, it's witty, it's funny, and there's a lot of truth to this. It's a really good book.
It is a hilarious book, yes.
Really, really good book. So Michael Graham's going to be joining us later on the show. We're also going to have MJ Rose.
Actually, she's on the line.
She's on the line. Okay. Well, we're going to get her right now. All right, we have MJ Rose on the line, author, journalist, and e-publishing guru from New York. MJ, welcome to the Book Show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Yeah.
You have a good week?
I did. Did you?
Nice. Really nice. Really nice week. It's not quite as cold today in Richmond as it has been.
It's not spring
Nor
yet
is
either.
It here. It's better here, too.
Well, that's good.
I finally could go swimming again. Not outside. Inside.
Right. Hey, before we get to your news items, there was one news item that I wanted to bring up. You familiar with Chief Moose? Remember Chief
Moose? Yes.
Okay.
I was watching that on television yesterday.
Oh, yeah? I mean, he wants to come out with a book, apparently. Apparently, he struck a deal with a publisher, and I don't know which publisher it is. I don't know if you know. But he wants to do a book, and obviously there must be some money involved.
Yes.
But there's a conflict because there's a law or strict rules that Montgomery County has for using the prestige of the office for personal gain.
Right. I actually heard that what they were thinking about doing was the county felt this book was important enough that they were going to pass a resolution excusing him from adhering to that law.
What do you think about that?
I think that everywhere else in the United States that I don't know about everywhere else, in New York, which
right.
I know, there's no law like that.
I see.
It's not using it for personal gain. It's not like he set up a crime in order to write a book about it.
Right.
He happened to be the chief officer in charge of a crime that gained national attention, and he has certain insights. As long as he's not abusing his jurisdiction and his position, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, the chief firefighter who was involved in
9/11.
World Trade Towers, I think that he wrote a book.
Yeah, you're right. I don't have a problem with it either.
Yeah.
I think it's fine.
You weren't sure, though.
Yeah. I just hope that everybody gets treated the same, you know?
Yeah, I think that it's more that Montgomery County has an odd law than it is the rest of the country does, too.
Right, right. All right, on to your news items. First, a new campaign to save ailing libraries.
Yeah, this is really scary. I don't know about you guys, but I use the library every week.
Same here. At least once a week we're there.
Yeah. And municipal budget cuts have led to library systems across the country having problems. And certainly after last night's speech, we know we can't look to, I mean, the federal government has enough things on its plate. It's not going to start helping municipal budgets. And the other problem is that a lot of librarians are getting older and a lot of new people aren't going into the field because the pay is so bad.
Really bad.
What is the pay?
I don't know.
Minimum wage?
The articles I've read. I mean, supposedly the budget has the federal budget has $20 million to help recruit librarians for museums and libraries.
Right.
But, you know, the libraries that I've talked to, they don't know when that's going to come. If it's going to come, it's in the budget. It doesn't mean it's going to get approved. Meanwhile, there's a problem, and somebody's going to have to figure out a solution. There was one suggestion that libraries start charging something.
Maybe fees.
Yeah, but
for some things.
You know, there's a really strange statistic, which is that the predominant, one would think that because books are free at the library, that it would be the lower class who uses the library the most and the middle and upper class that buys the most books.
Right.
But supposedly the greatest number of people going to the library are the middle to upper class.
Okay, here's an idea.
Go for it.
Why don't libraries do deals with major publishers? And, for example, if HarperCollins wants to have a special display or feature in a local library, Well, then Harper pays the local library some money, and Harper gets, you know, in front of thousands of readers, and the local library gets a little revenue from it.
That's really controversial. Boy, right. Is that controversial. Corporate sponsorship at libraries.
There you go.
I don't know.
It's an idea.
I don't know. Because then there's the whole argument becomes, then the person walking into the library doesn't see the books and get a fair, objective view of the books that are coming out. They're getting a subjective view of the books coming out based on what publishers have the most money to spend. An easier solution really seemed to me to just charge everybody $25 a year for joining the public library.
Right.
Even somebody who, I mean, if you don't have a lot of money, $25 a year is probably still something you can afford.
Mm-hmm. Either that or just charge a quarter every time you take out a book.
Well, that starts getting complicated. You need more people to collect the money.
But you have to check it out anyway.
It just seems so much easier. $25 to get a library card a year. And I don't think anybody wouldn't do it.
Sort of like a county sticker for your car.
Kids free. Kids free.
Yeah, a flat fee. That's an idea.
Kids free.
Kids free.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
So that, you know, anybody college age or under doesn't have to pay.
Right.
So the people who don't earn money don't have to pay. It doesn't become an undue burden on parents.
I like that idea.
Yeah, me too. Call the library system.
Yes.
All right, on to the next news item in our What's News publishing segment. California says BN.com must charge sales tax on in-state sales.
Yeah, this has been going on for a long time. Lots of fights between states and independent bookstores claiming that because Barnes & Noble and Amazon don't pay taxes, that the consumer who uses them don't have to pay state taxes, that the independent bookstore loses out because that's yet another fee that the book buyer doesn't have to pay by shopping online. So this is the first in a step of things that independent bookstores will be very happy about.
Now, this is going to hurt Barnes & Noble, won't it? I mean,
well, it's just going to be in the states so far where people, where there are stores. I mean, I didn't understand something about this. Maybe you did. There's a Barnes & Noble in every state.
You're right.
Right. Every state Barnes & Noble will take back the book you bought online. But this article says that it's just in California.
Maybe you're just the state of California is the only one that fought it.
Oh, I see. Okay, that makes sense.
That's the only thing I can think of.
Right, because at the end it says Arkansas and Minnesota have also adopted the same laws.
Yeah.
Now, the big question is Amazon doesn't have any stores. You know, any bricks and mortar stores.
Mm-hmm.
So based on this, nobody who shops at Amazon is going to have to pay state tax. But the question is, Amazon has formed an alliance with Borders. There are Borders in all 50 states.
Amazon, yes, and also Circuit City and a bunch of Toys R Us. You're right.
So one is wondering what's going to happen next with that. This is going to be an ongoing fight that's going to continue to be on the news, especially if the independent bookstore owners have any clout and can get their state legislatures to really look into this.
Right.
Because if you have to pay state tax and federal tax and shipping, all of a sudden it's not going to be a lot cheaper to buy your book at an online bookstore.
Right, yeah. Because they have so many employees and warehouses.
Right.
And California tax, if I remember, was pretty high when I was out there. It was like 7%. And my gosh, when you're only dealing with probably 1% of profit at Barnes & Noble on these books. Mm.
Well, I don't think it's that low.
Well, I know it's not too high.
All right, let's move on to the next news item. This is about a New York Times article about New Yorker fiction editor Deborah Treisman, and she is ruining the lack of submissions to her magazine by women.
Well, it's a really interesting thing. It's been going on for about 8 months. There's a website called MobyLives.com. And about a year ago, they started doing a weekly survey of how many articles, period, and then how many fiction pieces and poems that were in the magazine were written by women. And what they found was it was running about 8-3 in favor of men for every article in the magazine week after week after week.
Right.
And so there was a hue and a cry and arms, you know, went up, and everybody started screaming, more women, more women. So Deborah Treisman was made the new fiction editor when the last one retired or left about 2 months ago, and she's like come to the defense of the magazine saying that 8 out of 10 of all submissions are from men.
Right.
And that makes it very hard to publish half and half if 80% of all the submissions are from men.
That's logical.
Why do they need to publish half and half? Is there some unwritten rule that we have to have?
There's a very odd thing, which is that more than half of the books that are published are by women, and 80% of the readers in the United States who buy books are women.
Okay.
So it's a very peculiar skew that in every other aspect of publishing, it's not only half women, but it's 80% women, except in the premier magazine in the United States that deals with fiction, it's 80% men. Just one of those little things women tend to notice, you know, guys.
Well, it's a chance for men to make it up a little bit there.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry. Men, when you look at the highest advances in the industry,
right,
they're predominantly men also.
Why is that?
I just think men have more clout, and I think that I don't like it, but I think that we can scream all we want, but ultimately, you know, the publishing companies all have women at the second in command spots.
Right.
But almost every one of them has a man at the very top spot. There's still a glass ceiling. Hmm. It's still a man's world.
Oh. You're making us feel bad now. All right.
No, you don't feel bad. You were born that way. There's nothing you can do about it.
Right, right. All right. I'm assuming you want to talk about this last story that's Dobby.
Oh, I just think it's funny.
Funny.
There's a whole thing that Dobby from Harry Potter looks like Vladimir Putin.
Who's the president of Russia.
The BBC did a poll, and 77% of readers said that, yes, he does.
So that's the lookalike.
Ending on a light note, that's
all. All right, MJ, thanks so much for joining us on the book show. Have a terrific week. Take care. That's MJ Rose, author, journalist, and e-publishing guru, out of New York doing her What's News in Publishing segment on the book show.
Do you like to write? If so, Writer's Digest, the world's leading magazine for writers, is for you. Since 1920, Writer's Digest has provided expert writing instruction, inspiration, and up-to-date marketing information. Each month, readers turn to Writer's Digest to discover technique columns geared toward specific genres, including screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and more. Publishing information, including how to write solid cover and query letters that catch the interest of agents and editors. Tips and tricks for overcoming writer's block. Career opportunities. Interviews with best-selling authors. Tools of the trade, including the latest information on writing software and hardware, legal advice for writers, and more. Log on to www.writersdigest.com/thebookshow and ask for your 2 free issues. You'll see why more than 200,000 writers rely on Writer's Digest every month to learn the secrets of getting their words polished, published, and paid for.
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to enovel.com. At enovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. Enovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, Enovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.enovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.
The world of publishing is changing. More and more authors are self-publishing their work, and why shouldn't they? Self-publishing offers greater creative control and potential for greater financial reward than more traditional methods. That's why we started Self Publishers Digest, a how-to guide for authors that want to publish their own work successfully. Each month, we feature articles about writing, marketing, and promoting your self-published piece. All of the articles are written by authors who have self-published successfully. If you're interested in learning more about the world of self-publishing or submitting a story, please contact us at info@titanbeach.com. Or, if you're interested in display or classified advertising opportunities with Self-Publishers Digest, please contact Chris Ferguson at cferguson@titanbeach.com. Self-Publishers Digest, the path to self-publishing.
We're going to welcome Michael Graham, author of Redneck Nation, How the South Really Won the War, to the book show. Michael, welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here, and I got to say, Alex, I love your pizza. I just want you to know that.
Well, thank you very much. I wish I was the owner. Unfortunately,
it's not,
We're the poor Papa John's.
Is there not pizza involved in this gig? I was told there would be.
That
would
have been nice, I tell you.
I'm going to have to call my agent. Okay. what's up?
So what's up? Well, we got your book, Redneck Nation, and a really funny read.
Well, thank you.
Really enjoyed it. Really witty. And I got to know, how'd you come up with the idea?
I came up with the idea, actually, at a cocktail party in Westchester County, New York, surrounded by all these, you know, painfully liberal, Volvo-driving, wealthy, affluent, you know, Manhattan exurbanites standing around lecturing me on how crummy the South is and, you know, how, you know, we're all a bunch of inbred rednecks who, you know, are chasing our cousins, which is just really just annoys me because my cousin's not that good looking. But anyway, And I was, in all seriousness, I was at a cocktail party, and this guy's talking to me. He had grown up in Westchester County, like I said, a big-time political liberal, and he says, "Yeah, I was down in Fort Jackson as a kid, and I really love the South. I tell you, you know why I love the South? You know why? Because you really know how to treat your niggas." And I just, my eyes got like the size of plates. And I remember I just kind of muttered and stumbled away and just did that embarrassed, "Oh, my God, I can't believe you just said that in front of me" thing you do. And I started thinking about it. You know, these people assume that since I'm a white guy from the South that I must be this kind of, you know, redneck,
right,
secret
clan.
That's the assumption that they make. But this guy's politics, as I listened to his politics, first of all, the idea that he could just have this in his mind, this is, you know, the way to look at black people. But the more I listened to these people's politics on the left, the more I heard echoes of things that I'd heard growing up in rural South Carolina, whether it was obsession with race, you know, that race matters, everything's about race, and we used to divide you that way, whether it was this kind of, you know, bizarre, irrational religious leanings. I mean, there's nothing like being from the South and having gone to Oral Roberts University and having some guy just beating the crap out of you for being some kind of, right, how can you believe that idiotic, irrational nonsense? And while he's doing this, he's wearing a healing crystal around his neck.
Sure.
You know, he thinks that he's the reincarnated, you know, butler of Napoleon's, and he watches John Edwards TV psychic in his spare time. And, well, I'm going to let you beat me up? And so suddenly, as I started thinking about not the words that Northeastern liberals were using, not the phrases that California liberals were using, but the ideas that they were expressing, it suddenly dawned on me, oh, my God, you guys have adapted all of the hideous redneck ideas of the people who used to chase me around and call me nigger lover, and you've turned them into your political world, and you don't even get it. I'm not the redneck anymore. You are. And so that's how we came up with Redneck Nation, how the South really won the war.
Now, give us a little bit of your background. Where are you from? Where'd you go to
school?
Well,
I mean, you were laughing, but you say the book is funny. Sadly, it's my life. So you're just laughing at the way I live my life. I was born in L.A., but I grew up in rural South Carolina. My mom's from Long Beach, California. My dad's from Myrtle Beach. So I'm bicoastal, except you can't tell people in the South that you're bi-coastal because they think that means you date guys on the beach. But I grew up in just the worst. You know, a lot of Southerners who've read the book love the parts that kick Northerners and kick liberals, but they get bugged. Because I do make fun of the South. I make fun of everybody. Mm-hmm. And I try to explain them. I had the worst Southern experience. I grew up in a little town, Peelion, South Carolina, population 211, including livestock.
211?
Yeah. Which,
wow.
Which, by the way, explains my prom date pretty much right there. But I was surrounded by large, hairy. I spent my formative years running from large, hairy people named Bubba, many of them women. And all of the worst of the South I saw up close and personal every day. I mean,
right.
I went to a school where Deliverance was shown as, you know, as a documentary. And so then I went to college. I went to Oral Roberts University. When I got out, you know, people were laughing at my degree. Well, Oral Roberts University, which, by the way, before you mock it, I put the oral in Oral Roberts. Thank you.
Well, that's what we can't figure out.
Why I went to Oral Roberts?
I mean, you're a self-described smartass,
right,
in the book.
Yes.
And you know, my stereotype of Oral Roberts are these straight-laced, goody-goody types.
You're absolutely right.
And I
was just as unpopular at Oral Roberts as I was back in Peelion, South Carolina.
Right.
I went to Oral Roberts for a lot of reasons. One is it was the school the farthest from South Carolina that offered me a full scholarship. But another reason was that I grew up in a church. My family, I went to church 3 or 4 times a week, and my religion was very important to me. So I went there, this, you know, evangelical, looking for answers, and I left an infidel. So I don't know if that worked out too well for everybody concerned. But I went to Oral Roberts, and then people, what do you do with a diploma from Oral Roberts University? I have a degree in fundraising.
There you go.
So please buy the book, because if you don't, God's going to take me. No, but I graduated, so people were laughing at me, so I started doing stand-up comedy, and it worked out pretty well. And I traveled the country. I did 41 states as a stand-up comic, had a great time, coast to coast, north, south, east, west, and I discovered something. No matter where I went in this great state and nation of ours, people would mock you from being from down south.
Really?
And that's why I got my friend. And at first, I was the mocker. I mean, I was with them. I was like, you're absolutely right. Those people are boneheads down there. I mean, I really – the working title for Redneck Nation as I was writing it was Confessions of a Reluctant Southerner. I mean, I really grew up not wanting to be a Southerner because, once again, I saw – the ugly underside, and that's all I could see. I couldn't get past the fact that I was surrounded by toothless goobers who really thought you should beat the crap out of somebody because he was black. I mean, that's what they really – it wasn't a put on. I mean, that's the way they lived.
Right.
And then but as I traveled around the country doing stand-up comedy and then through a series of bizarre mistakes became a political consultant and traveled again. I went working campaigns in Chicago and New York and elsewhere.
What party?
Republican. I'm definitely Republican Party. Okay. And I'm a definitely right-wing nut job. But one
you fit in well here, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Good. No, I'm glad to.
Welcome home.
Yeah, no kidding. But as I traveled around, you know, being mocking Southerners, I would sit and have conversations with people and about their worldview and their life and how they lived. And I couldn't get beyond the ideas that they were expressing. I mean, nothing was more bizarre to me. Once again, going to Westchester County, New York, having a conversation with somebody about school choice, and vouchers and educational freedom. Why do we keep kids trapped in hideous, awful public schools that know for a fact suck? I mean, you look at that, specific schools, you can look at them and go, that's a disaster area.
Sure.
And I'm talking to this guy, once again, Volvo driving, Ajay, how are you, listens to NPR, that whole bit, telling me about what a right-winger I am, how terrible I am for supporting school vouchers, and I keep going, what about these kids?
That's right.
Don't you care about the kids? I mean, my God, I can't believe that as a Northeasterner, you don't think that public school, that education is important. I know Southerners have schools that suck. We're supposed to, remember? We're supposed to be the stupid ones, remember? I mean, I'm no joke. My fourth grade teacher in public schools told me I read too much. Not the shop teacher. I mean, this is the teacher with all her fingers who said I read too much. I said, I don't understand how you can oppose this. And what it came down to is he didn't want those kids, by which he meant black and minority kids, coming to his school. And here was his conclusion. Well, Michael, you're from down south. You're used to being around those people. I'm from Westchester County. I'm not. And I don't want my kids going to school with them. Oh my God. You're not a liberal. You're a Klan member. Oh, my God. I mean, everything you've just – education is not as important as protecting your kids from going to school with the wrong people. That's exactly what the White Conservative Council said in the 1950s and 60s.
We all know the teachers' union is in the Democratic Party's pocket, and what they want to do is protect their jobs. They want to protect their monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want.
But once again, the Redneck Nation starts off – with a chapter called Joe Lieberman Redneck, and it talks about how you had freedom riders, freedom fighters coming to the South in the 1960s, supposedly expressing a certain set of ideas and confronting the ideas of the South. One of those ideas was, should race matter? The South said yes, the North said no. The other thing you mentioned, the unions, though, the Northerners said merit should matter, that it should matter what you can accomplish, what your abilities are. Southerners said, no, it should matter who's your mama. Who's
your mama?
Yeah, who's your daddy? Do I know you? Are you one of us? And sadly, what you're seeing in the case of education is a reversal now where you have Northeastern liberals saying, I don't care if these teachers are competent. I don't care if they're good at what they do. I don't care how dumb the kids are they graduate. They're one of us. They're in the union. Yeah. They're part of our team. So you can go ahead and suck as long as you suck on my team, which is exactly what I grew up with D.F. Shumpert at Shumpert's store down in South Carolina, where the only guys who got jobs were people who were related to the boss. It's exact same thing. I thought merit was supposed to matter. Back in the day, liberals and Northerners said it did.
Today, well, back then, also, the South was Democratic.
Yeah.
They moved the Democrats up north. They took those ideas with them.
It is interesting how it happened. I don't know if I know yet how it happened, but no doubt about it, from coast to coast, from Malibu to Manhattan, we live in a redneck nation. It is absolutely true.
All right. In the book, you say every one of the fundamental Southern ideas I spent my life opposing has been accepted and absorbed by our nation as a whole. So why don't you take one or two of those ideas?
Is NASCAR
race
included there?
Well, NASCAR, yeah, absolutely. NASCAR is included. But race is the easy and obvious one, and that's why I keep coming back to it, because you're going to see it right on its face. The premise of Southern life through Jim Crow and segregation was race should matter. The freedom riders came south and said, no, it shouldn't. Now today, 40 years later, in northeastern enclaves like Dartmouth and Cornell universities, you have racially segregated dorms and racially segregated floors in student housing. You know why?
Wow.
Because the black and minority students demand them.
Right.
And so a black leader in Boston, who was part of this "We Need More Segregated Dorms" movement, his defense of it was, quote, "Well, black people don't learn the same way as white people," close quote.
But he can say that.
Oh, my God. Well, no, he can't say it. Not around me, he can't say that.
I know. That's
because
what I'm saying.
The head of the Klan, when I was 12, told me the exact same thing. I'm sorry. No, you're absolutely wrong. In the 2000 census, the United States government, not the Confederate States of America government, the United States government sent out a census document with 126 different racial and ethnic categories for us to divide ourselves into. 126 ways for me to not be the same kind of American as you are. I mean, my right. God, Jefferson Davis would have stopped at quadroons and octoroons. These guys have got you down to, you know, left-handed mulattoes named Shirley. I'm like, what are you doing to me? So that's obviously, if the fight was between Northerners who said race shouldn't matter and Southerners who said race should, if that was the war of the 1960s, the civil rights struggle, who won? Obviously the South won.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Now, let me give you another obvious example. Women. Northerners have this attitude about Southern women, like they're all this bunch of genteel little flowers. I say, y'all, I don't say breast, I say white meat. Excuse me, y'all. You know, I mean, that's this attitude that women are, supposedly we Southerners think that women are genteel little flowers and must be protected, that daddy's got to step in and protect that little girl because she can't handle it. And supposedly feminists came down and said, no, women are strong, women are tough, women are just as tough as men are. Today, year 2002, we have college campuses where great works of art like the Naked Maja by Goya, I think it is, although it's in the book, I probably screwed up the artist, but it's a classic work of art of a woman with her breastular area exposed. Professors at University of Pennsylvania are taking those works of art down from their classrooms because it creates a, quote, hostile workplace environment. These supposedly women hear me roar type feminists are such weak-kneed wimps that they can't even work in the presence of a Snap-on tool calendar without fainting and getting a case of the fantods. Okay, excuse me? Who was fighting for the idea that women were strong? Who was supposedly saying that women were weak? We flip that. Now, the other vision of Southern womanhood, in addition to the genteel flower, was the trailer trash.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing has astonished me more here in the year 2003 than the fact that one of the paradigms, one of the models of female behavior for Northern liberals is Sex in the City on HBO, which is absolutely nothing but white trash. I mean, that's all it is. I mean, I can't believe – how did this – do we have a hit TV show based on an activity that the Johnson twins used to do in the trailer park behind my school for 25 cents? I mean, you want a guy who will hump the UPS man on the porch? I knew her. So whether it's white trash women who are, looking for anything that's longer than it is wide, or whether it's, genteel women who can't stand to, be in the presence of anything offensive – the Southern stereotype of womanhood has now prevailed. Where are the feminists who are saying women are tough and strong? You know what they're doing? They're all filing lawsuits against guys who use the word Dolores from the TV show Seinfeld in their presence. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I'm stunned by it, and that's why this is I wrote Redneck Nation, because that's what's happening.
How about the rejection of merit? You say in the South, it's a Southern idea that merit
Southerners
doesn't matter.
Southerners never big on merit. We never like the idea of competition. We always like the idea of covering each other's backs. Hey, Virgil, I won't tell anyone you actually dropped the engine out of the bottom of that car by accident. You don't tell anybody that I backed up the tow truck into mama's car, okay? I mean, that was this presumed incompetence that always drove me crazy. Growing up, whether it was in public school, in high school, where they're curving, I mean, they would grade tests on curves so extreme that even Dolly Parton would blush. Whether it was that, and I believed as a kid growing up in the South that somewhere out there was a place where people would not say, "How long have you lived here? What do you look like?" Or who's your daddy, that all they would say is, what can you accomplish? I believed that place existed because I was told through the media that that was the North. No, absolutely not. You travel coast to coast, and it is all about, what do you look like? Here's a job for you if you're the right color. Here's a position for you if you're the right sex. Here's a praise for you if you're on the right political party. It may not be based on, who your cousin is, but it's all based on this identity politics versus individuals simply achieving. Don't we believe that the best person should win out? No. Across the country, people say, absolutely not. Not unless he fits into one of these other groups first.
And affirmative action is a good
example. That's a perfect example. I mean, when Dr. Martin Luther King stood up and said, I have a dream that one day my children will be judged not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. Mm-hmm. I really think that that was the seminal statement of what the future of America should be. Southerners opposed him. They said, no, we are going to judge people on the color of their skin. And that was the struggle that we fought. today, you cannot find anybody. Hillary Rodham just gave a speech on the floor of the Senate for Martin Luther King Day, in which she said that, you know, she quoted that quote, and then she said, mm-hmm. but you have to remember, the color of your skin is the content of your character.
What?
Well, once again, if I heard that from, you know, a segregationist, you know, if George Wallace said that standing in the doorway of the University of Alabama, I wouldn't be surprised. But for a northern liberal sure. to say that shows just how far they've gotten away from the idea of merit and individual achievement, mm-hmm. which is what I think they used to stand for.
How about you say America, the place where you can avoid personal responsibility?
Yeah, the idea that that you're responsible for the consequences of your own actions, and that you should suffer some penalty for them. Once again, you know, in the good old boy South, if you're one of the good old boys, people would find a way to let you off the hook. You see this in politics all the time. You right. know, some big time statewide official gets in trouble. Who gets fired? You know, some third flunky from the left down the hall. You know, well, we can't fire old Bubba. He's our buddy. You know old Bubba. You know?
Right.
Well, and that idea that somehow it's always somebody else's fault, because it can't be my friend's fault. It can't be my buddy's fault. It can't be my, you know, my cousin's fault. It's got to be someone else's fault. No doubt about it. That is the country we live in.
But that's
today.
Become also the whole union in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, you just can't touch them.
It's unionism, the idea of, we're all going to find that no matter what happens, we're not going to let a union member be held responsible for his actions. But I would take it beyond that to society. We have a nation full of people who don't want justice, who mm-hmm. want some form of injustice. Look at the lawsuit against McDonald's.
Oh, I know.
You got an 18-year-old kid who, by his own testimony, ate at McDonald's three times a day, every day for 2 years, and then was astonished to find out, oh my God, I'm a huge lard ass.
Yeah,
how did that happen?
I'm not healthy
anymore. Somehow
this
must be McDonald's fault. It must be, because it can't be mine. And once again, I'm speaking broadly now, there was this kind of northern paradigm for a while of, you know, Southerners, you've got this screwed up society because you're choosing to do these things that you really ought not be doing. Southerners saying, no, it's not our fault at all. Somehow it's just the way the world is. We can't do nothing about it. And Northerners came in and said, no, action, consequence. That idea has been rejected. Sorry, no one believes in that anymore. They believe in action. I act, you suffer the consequence. Somehow it's got to be your fault.
How about flat tax? How's that fit into the...
Is it in the book? I don't remember. Did I write about flat taxes? One way it falls in for me in the Michael Graham worldview is the idea that, you know, we should all be in this together and we should all be in it equally.
Right.
I could have, if I'd wanted, I tried. I hope the book is funny. I hope, but
it is.
I could
it is
have
hilarious.
Written. I could have written a, you know, a more serious book and taken the, you know, kind of philosophical and legal issues and written.
You wouldn't
have
sold any.
Yeah. Well, exactly. but if you wrote, I could have written a whole chapter on the idea of equal treatment under the law, which is once again, classic civil rights fight.
Right.
You know, the South used to have laws for different people. If you were white, you could, you know, here was a law for you. If you were black, here was a law for you. And I don't mean just the ripoffs of, you know, convicting more black people of murder than white people because of racism. Except for that, it was actually written in code. If you are a black person, you cannot do X. You cannot do Y. I mean, that was the law.
Right.
So you'd go to the same judge, same court. He'd look at you and say, okay, this is your law, this is your law. That outraged Americans. So today, what happens? You go to the court of the IRS. Oh, you owe 17% of everything you make to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Bill Gates, I'm sorry, you owe 55% of everything you make to the federal government. And Steve, you owe 29%. And it's all this, it's individual laws for individual people, as opposed to that concept of we're all in this together, we're all Americans, let's all chip in X percent
yep.
and have it work. Not because I like what you do with your money, and maybe I think Bill Gates is evil. I don't even care about that. But because under the law, we should all, you know, have that same just sword fall evenly. Second example, and this is the extreme example, hate crimes laws. You know, I mean, it never ceases to amaze me how many liberals will rail about, you know, in the 1960s down south, a white man will walk in front of a judge and have killed a black man, and he would get one set of treatment, and a black man would walk in and kill a white man, and he would get, you know, white man, he'd get lynched. I agree, that was terrible. So today, what happens? A black guy goes in front of a judge who just beat up a white guy on the street corner, he gets charged with assault. A white guy goes in front of that same judge, having beaten up a black guy, he gets charged with a hate crime.
Hate crime
and faces
exactly.
twice as much time in prison. Not because of the actions, which are identical, not because of the consequences, which are identical, but because of the color of the skin of the people involved. Who in the world can possibly say that the South did not win the Civil Rights War? Who can say we do not live in a redneck nation? It's just astonishing to me. And then to hear liberals, we've got to have different treatment under the law. What? What? It's like I've gone to a time machine back to Pelion, except for the guy who's just the local mayor with his finger up his butt is now the president. He's now the senator. He's now everything. I just can't believe it.
You talk about the great Southern sports of wrestling and NASCAR,
and how
they've gotten to be national sports.
It's so amazing to me.
And are they sports?
You write a book, and you work so hard on certain parts, you know, on the chapters about, like, you know, like hate crimes laws. I did all this legal research in the chapters about race, and there's a whole chapter on religion and, you know, how Southerners were always put down for their religion, and I do all this research. And then I go, you know, I'd have a chapter in sports. I'm interested in it. So I throw together this little chapter of just my observations. I get more hate mail on the sports
on
chapter.
That? You don't know
Man,
what
people are just red hot about the fact that I point out that NASCAR is not a sport. NASCAR is not a sport. That
because,
doesn't mean
because.
That it's not a sport because it's not a competition between athletes. A sport is a competition in which all other things being equal, athletic prowess will determine. You know, Michael Jordan and anyone else in the NBA can practice all they want, but when they get on the court, Michael Jordan's going to win because he's a superior athlete. Mm-hmm. And the strategy has some impact, obviously. You know, whether you can play man for man or zone, that all has impact, but all things being equal, that's an athletic competition. Golf, therefore, obviously, is not a sport. It's a game of skill. Now, I'm not saying it's not worth watching or not worth doing. I mean, it's like saying, well, chess sucks because chess is... No, chess is what... I mean, they're all what they are.
Right.
They're all entertaining and they're all a lot of fun. They're all forms of entertainment. Yeah. Golf is not a sport. Any competition in which John Daly can be the champion is clearly not a sport. It's not an athletic competition. And NASCAR the same way. NASCAR is a competition between vehicles. Whoever has the best car, all other things being equal, is going to win, period. If you got the best car now... Does strategy count? Absolutely. But way down the line, do you get to the point where the physical condition of the drivers determines who wins the race? You got to be in good shape. It's a hard thing to do. They lose lots of body weight, and they consume a lot of calories. Once again, I'm not saying that it doesn't require – you can't do it if you're in a wheelchair or whatever. But it's not a competition between athletes. If you think NASCAR is a sport because you get hot and sweaty doing it, I got the next new sport for you. We'll lock 50 women in an un-air-conditioned warehouse in New Mexico and watch them speed type for an hour. And whoever types the fastest wins. No,
right.
They're going to come out tired and sweaty. That's not a sport. What does it take to be a great – but lumping all of them together, setting that aside, lumping NASCAR, wrestling, baseball, football, what does it take to be a great Southern sport? Two things. Number one, you got to have easy-to-understand rules. We Southerners don't like these companies. All that, curling, forget about it. I don't know. How do you keep track of all that? We don't like that. Second thing you got to have, there has to be at least the theoretical possibility of something getting blowed up real good.
Right.
You put those two together.
I wrote that down.
Now, in the 1960s, the dominant sport in America, up through, in fact, for the whole, from 1900 to 1960, the dominant sport in America, clearly baseball. Baseball was the national pastime. Pollsters showed it. Participation showed it. More people played it. More people watched it. More people went. Sure, football popular. It was around, particularly down south. College football always popular. Mm-hmm. Hockey was up north, and no one south of D.C. even knew what the heck it was. In fact, that is, I got to tell you, if you could transport the typical Alabama redneck in time from 1950 to today, I think the thing that would amaze him most of everything that's going on in America, even more amazing than Condoleezza Rice being the head of national security, would be the fact that one of the most popular sporting events in America is now a group of white guys wearing white masks and holding sticks and beating the crap out of people. He never would have believed that. Hey, this is just like the good old days. Dang. But what happened between 1960 when baseball was dominant and football, basketball way back, hockey didn't even exist, wrestling was just kind of there. What happened so that in the year 2003, the number one spectator sport in America, NASCAR, number one. Number two, football. Hockey's way up. I think hockey is either number three or number four, depending on basketball. It's right together. And the other rising sports are tough man and strong man competitions. I think the XFL was just 2 years early.
Right.
If they'd waited the XFL until after the Osbournes became a hit. Because that's what XFL was. It was football for the Osbournes. Mm-hmm. I think it will be a hit today. What's the trend here? One of the trends is... obviously, the chances of something get blown up real good. People get hurt in baseball sometimes. You get a few collisions at the plate, but it's not a collision sport. Football, wrestling, NASCAR, they're all about the collisions. I mean, that's what it is. You see the highlight reels from the NFL. They don't show you that, that lineman doing that great block that just lets the running back slip by and make that key 7 yards for the strategic plot to win the game. No. They show you Jerry Rice getting, clotheslined by some guy doing a 360 over his arm out in the middle of the field. That's what they show you. I mean, when you see the hits, man, that's what it's about. NASCAR, Every time some NASCAR nut tells me, it's about the sport, it's about the strategy. Yank. It's about seeing something go boom. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
If you could invent NASCAR's cars that could run 200 miles an hour but were made entirely out of foam rubber, nobody would watch.
Right.
Nobody. There would be 9 people in the stands going, ooh, look at that strategy. No, they want to see rubbing is racing, man, which is, once again, is fine. But how did that, you know, that kind of Southern stereotype sport contest, you know, NASCAR, which nobody followed north of the Mason-Dixon line when I was a kid. No, I mean, I went to a race. I went to the Darlington 500 when I was like in 6 or 7, 8, something like that. And there was a big crowd there, but there were no TV cameras there. I mean, it was all this insider kind of Southern thing. What happened? You know where the tracks are being built now? The tracks now are being built in New Hampshire, Chicago, yeah. Oregon. I mean, that's where the growth is, because America's gone from a country where baseball was the dominant sport to a country where people are going, ooh, blow it up real good. That's what's going on. And it's, the fact that it's Manhattan Wall, you know, brokers or Chicago lawyers are doing, doesn't change the same thing. They all want the same thing. Yeah, and, you know, it's so funny because baseball was number one. I have a quote in the book. It's absolutely true. Someone was trying to explain to me the reason baseball is less popular is that baseball is, quote, too intellectual, close quote.
Yeah.
Intellectual. I never thought I would ever hear someone describe baseball as intellectual. Yeah. I mean, in France, to be intellectual, you got to read like Marcel Proust or something. In America, to be intellectual, you got to understand the infield fly rule. How did that happen? Well, it's because that we're a redneck nation. That's why.
I want to ask you a question about domestic politics.
Sure. Go ahead.
What's your opinion about the Trent Lott affair and how that turned out?
I think there are two things. One is, no doubt about it, you know, Democrats, liberals, opportunists, they seized upon it and milked everything out of that cow they could. But the second thing that we Southerners sometimes don't like to acknowledge is, in fact, there was a cow to milk. I mean, Trent Lott's problem was not that he made a comment at Strom Thurmond's birthday party.
My gosh, he's making an old guy feel good.
Exactly. That's not what killed him. If it had just been that, if it had been, I'm trying to think of who's an example, if it had been Bill Frist making that comment, if it had been, you know, Congresswoman Nancy Johnson from Connecticut making that comment, it would have been, people would have gone, oh, that was a stupid thing to say, and, you know, a day later, 2 days later, they would have been dead. The problem is, Trent Lott spent his entire career as a segregationist.
Yeah.
He worked for segregation candidates in the 1960s. He, you know, openly, he met with the conservative citizens councils, which is, I'm not going to condemn them on their face as, like, secret Klan members. I think that's an extreme, but there's certainly people who have questionable opinions, or opinions that are far out of the mainstream on the issues of race. And he was meeting with them in the 1990s. He had 30 years of his career to stand up and say, you know what? In the 1960s and early 70s, I did some things and I had positions that now I look back and I go, man, I was an idiot. I was just wrong. I've learned that lesson. He never did. And because he had 30 years to do it and never did, that's what nailed it.
Gotcha.
They went back and they got more and more and more and more and more. And all, you know what? George Wallace could have made the comment about Strom Thurmond and it wouldn't have been as big a deal, because George Wallace at some point in the 80s stood up and said, I was wrong. God, the attitude that we had back then, it was just upside down and we didn't see it at the time. And we all, because Americans, North and South, understand the concept of redemption. Look, Americans, North and South, almost all of us have had opinions about things, particularly race, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that we look back on and go, man, that was dopey. All, you know, it's a process of learning. It's a process of growing. Trent Lott never took that moment, ever, at the many times he had the chance to. That's why he got killed. And I got to tell you, in a kind of an ironic twist, I love the fact that it was because of Strom Thurmond. I mean, I'm from South Carolina. I grew up in South Carolina, and I'm not going to make a story. I mean, how can you make fun of Strom Thurmond? The guy was a hero. Did you know he was at the Normandy invasion?
Oh, yeah, I read that.
Absolutely, it was in the Normandy invasion.
Yeah,
there was
that.
The Saxons, 1066, the Normans coming across. It was amazing.
Yeah.
No. Gotcha. Strom Thurmond participated in D-Day in 1944. In fact, he was the oldest American to participate in the D-Day invasion.
Wow.
Right. 1944, he was already the oldest guy in the group. It's just astonishing. You know what? Strom Thurmond didn't even start his Senate career until he was 52.
That's amazing.
And he ended up being the longest. I mean, the guy, when Strom Thurmond was 44, this is absolutely true, he married a 22-year-old Miss South Carolina beauty pageant winner.
Smart guy.
When Strom Thurmond turned 66,
just better.
He married a 22-year-old Miss South Carolina beauty pageant winner. When Strom Thurmond turned 88, nobody wanted to be Miss South Carolina. They canceled the contest. Nobody wanted to do it. But I ran a primary against Strom Thurmond in 1996 as a political consultant. I ran a candidate against him. And I really think that doing that, I was a part of a kind of a movement of Southerners, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from the book Redneck Nation from people by email and stuff. A bunch of Southerners who said, you know, I don't want to hate the South. I don't want to just walk away from all of it because there's too much cool stuff about it. The people are just too great. The food is great. The willingness to let people be goofy around you, that tight sphinctered Northerners just won't do anymore. It's too good to let it go. At the same time, I can't do what my dad is doing and pretend that we never did anything wrong. I can't pretend that the Civil War was not about slavery. I can't pretend that, you know, segregation was a good thing and everybody liked it. I mean, I can't pretend that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's another path there. And I hope that in some small way that Redneck Nation is kind of marching that path of saying, you know, there are a bunch of us Southerners who learned the good lessons from the Civil Rights Movement. We learned it. And we are creating, you know, we're living this new world that combines some of the best of the South and the best of the North, and we're enjoying life down here. And what's making us frustrated is we look north for people who to walk down this road with us of equal treatment under the law and not having race matter as much and deciding it is better to be smart than to be dumb. And you've abandoned us. So we've got a generation behind us down the South who we're kind of rebelling against or working away from. We wish more of you supposed liberals who used to believe in liberty but are now a bunch of freaking, you know, smoke Nazis and race Nazis. We wish you would join us, and that's that new path. And there are a bunch of Southerners, particularly, you know, they're in their 40s and younger, who have cut that new path. And I believe that in my lifetime, the joke is going to be that the bastion of free thinking, free speech, you know, anti-racism and opportunity is going to be the old Confederacy, and the redneck lost lands where people are just laughing every day and pointing like we used to do at Kentucky are going to be, you know, Berkeley, California, Manhattan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. That is what's happening now as the liberal, the left and northeasterners and that liberal establishment continue to get more and more lost in their dumb ideas. I'm afraid that one day we're all going to have to get on buses and go north and say, hey, wake up, you morons. Race isn't supposed to matter, remember? Merit's supposed to matter, remember? What's wrong with you? Here, this is a baseball. Learn it, love it, be it. We're going to have to do that.
Where is the South? I mean,
that's an interesting question. There's a great book called 1001 Things Everyone Should Know About the South that a friend of mine, John Shelton Reed, wrote, and he did several studies. The U.S. Census says the South is the old Mason-Dixon line, which includes Maryland and Delaware. Nobody
no
includes
one.
Maryland in the South. Yeah, Maryland is just absolute. Yeah. Maryland is, you know, is like Moscow East. I mean, West.
Although they did get a Republican governor.
Yeah, but still, I'm telling you, I've lived there. It is a scary place. I have a bunch of stuff in Montgomery County, Maryland in there, which is exactly the world that Lenin wanted to live in one day. But other people, you know, say it's any state that fought with the Confederacy. Of course, that raises issues because Kentucky, you know, was invaded by the North, and it was a swing state. Maryland, actually, the citizens wanted to fight with the Confederacy, and the government wouldn't let them. And so that's a hard measure. The 1,000 things everyone should know about the South. He does something I think is probably the best determinant of the South. He goes through the phone books and does an analysis of how many places you go where you find Dixie as a listing in the Yellow Pages. And Dixie Electronics, Dixie Seafood, mm-hmm. Dixie Hairstyling, whatever.
Right.
And that map, it's amazing how accurate it is. Because, you know, ground zero for it is around Montgomery, Alabama. And as you get, you know, farther north and farther west, they fade away. And so that's why if you're in a place where you can have Dixie as the name of your thing and it's
okay.
popular, you're in the South. If you have the name Dixie and people are marching outside, you're in the North. I think that's probably the best measure of where the South is.
Now, where is this book being sold? Everywhere?
Barnes
& Noble?
That's one of the cool things. I did a self-publish in the year 2000. I write a column that runs in the South called the Usual Suspects, and some people asked me to compile the columns.
Sure.
So at the end of the Clinton administration, I took, you know, 8 years, the best of my writings under his term, and wrote a book called Clinton and Me, How 8 Years of a Pants-Free President Changed My Nation, My Family, and My Life. And it did well as a self-published, but it was limited release because I was distributing it myself. For all of you out there thinking about doing a self-publish, the good news is you make more of a cut. The bad news is no one can find your book. Now, Amazon.com is changing that, but
absolutely.
But it's still a challenge. But because of the success of that book, Warner Books in New York contacted me. They don't have any conservatives in their stable. They wanted a conservative writer, they told me, and so they contacted me and had me do Redneck Nation, How the South Really Won the War. And And because it's with Warner, it's everywhere. And I've gotten fan mail and hate mail from, you know, California and Alaska, and it's really out there, and it's really interesting to hear from it.
It's on the bestseller list, right?
It was. You know, early on. Yeah, it's done, particularly given, I'm a quote regional writer. It's done very well. It did very well before Christmas as a Christmas gift, and it's picked back up since you have the post-Christmas downfall. I guess got a note from Warner Books. And, you know, people are buying it. Southerners are buying it for their northerners who have moved south to try to smack them around. Northerners are buying it for their southern friends who are stuck up north to just give them some ammo against the enemy. You know, people who have relatives, you know, dads who listen to Rush Limbaugh and stuff are buying it for them as Christmas gifts. But the main thing is, I guess my last argument against the North is, who's having the most fun? Who's telling the most jokes? Who's laughing the most? You know, when I grew up in the South, there was a real attitude of, you know, if you can't say something nice kind of thing. You know, if you can't say something nice, drink was pretty much what I grew up with. And I could never hold my liquor or hold my tongue, so I was always in trouble. But my wife's philosophy really is, as a true old school Southerner, anything that's actually funny enough to get people to laugh should probably not be repeated in public. And that was the attitude south. Now that's completely flipped. When you're traveling the country, you never cease to amaze me. The people who are having a good time are the people who live in the South. Not necessarily even Southerners. People who've migrated down south, who just got tired of the constricted attitudes in New Jersey and, you know, in Minnesota. And they're here, and they're having a good time. This is where it is. And, you know, if Lenny Bruce came back today, he would have to work in the South, because they would throw him out of every major city, you know, north of the
Weren't you thrown off radio, public radio or something?
Yeah, but that was down south. I was banned from public radio. That was about politics, so I made the mistake of making fun of the state legislature.
That was your first book was labeled that, right?
That's right.
Michael, you were mentioning about how funny a lot of the Southerners are, right? Now, is that one reason why it seems like the most popular radio talk show hosts are conservatives?
I think it is. I mean, I really think that
they're firebrands. They got passion.
Liberals have lost the idea of mockery. You can't mock anybody if they're, you know, oh, I don't want to offend anybody. I keep talking about Westchester County. Well, Westchester County, St. Patrick's Day is coming up, and a local town, Mamaroneck, I think it was supposed to have a regularly scheduled city council meeting. Someone pointed out, it's going to be St. Patrick's Day. And one of the people, a woman on the city council, said, well, we can't meet then because, you know, all the Irish will be drunk. Oh, my gosh, you'd think that she'd, you know, called for, like, you know, prison labor camps or something. Oh, headlines and screaming and yelling. The punchline, the woman was Irish. All the Irish people on the council were laughing. And yet she had to apologize. I'm so sorry, I've humiliated her. I mean, down south she wouldn't have had to apologize because it was a joke. And we get the fact that it's a joke. And it is, you know, there was a time when the motto of the South was, anything that offends somebody should not be said, while the attitude of the free speech movement from Berkeley, California, and from, you know, Columbia University in New York was, no, offend, get the ideas out there. We need the ideas to clash against you. Don't worry about stepping on toes. That was the attitude. Once again, now it's completely flipped. People in Berkeley, California are burning campus newspapers because they don't like the ads in them. Burning print. You know, well, once you get the jackboots and the swastikas, you'll have it all made. And yet it's down south. The people are going, oh, come on, laugh, get over it. What's the big deal?
That's amazing.
Why I have formed a group. And ladies and gentlemen, you can be a part of this group. I formed a group called People Offended by Offended People. Poop. We here at Poop are absolutely offended that other people are offended by completely reasonable things. Your offense offends me. Therefore, I demand that you stop being offended because your offense offends me. And Poop is hugely popular. And I'm telling you, Poop is rising across the South. Look for a Poop everywhere because we're just tired of people getting offended by every little thing. And that's, conservatives are willing to say things that they believe to be true, regardless of whether or not somebody whines about it. Liberals are so concerned about anyone being offended that they can't say anything at all.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing with your time right now, and what's the future hold? Any more books, for example?
Well, I just got an email actually last week from Warner Books. Are interested in another book, and we're kind of debating which one. I really want to write a book about religion. They're nervous about it, but I think it's hilarious. I think people show some of their funniest sides when they get involved in religion discussion. So I want to write a book about that, but they're kind of iffy, sketchy on that. We'll see what happens. And I'm going to be a regular guest on Bill Maher's new HBO show.
Sure.
It's called Real Time. It's going to be Friday nights live to the East Coast, which is really going to be cool. It's not going to be the PI format, but they're going to have a PI segment. Mm-hmm. It's more of a traditional talk show. And he's asked a group of us to be regular guests, and they're going to rotate us in and out. So he's getting ready to do 10 episodes, and I will be on Several of them. I don't know.
And when's that supposed to start?
It starts February 21st, Friday night.
It's exciting.
I won't be on the first show. I know that because they're going to front load it with celebrities for obvious reasons.
Will you be flying up to New York then?
No, it's actually doing in L.A. So I'll fly out to L.A. And thanks to the magic of radio, as you guys are experiencing, I'll actually be doing my daily show from L.A. that day and then going over and doing the Bill Maher show.
Fun.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That sounds great.
It comes out of nowhere. You know what it is? It's the willingness to have a good time. And, you know, he's looking for conservatives who are willing to mix it up and have a good time.
Sure.
That's all it takes.
And listen, you're married to a Southern girl here.
That's right. Absolutely.
And she's letting you go?
Yeah. Permission from the warden.
Yeah, exactly.
My wife, the warden. I call my wife the warden in the book and on the show. And you know what's so funny to me? I get asked all the time why I call her the warden, but I've never been asked that question by a married guy. Yeah, the married guys don't have to ask. They know why she's the warden.
Alex knows who.
Women ask me, oh, why do you call her the warden? The single guys, oh, what do you call No, married guys, they hear the warden, they just look at me and go, I know, absolutely.
Well, Jack, anything else you got?
No, that's about it. We're kind of close on time. But just on a final note,
sure.
2004 elections.
I'm on my knees every day praying, oh, Lord, I know I've been very, very bad and you really shouldn't listen to me, but please, Democrat Al Sharpton, please God. Al Sharpton is the Pat Buchanan of the Democratic Party.
That's a good analogy.
Except he's 50 times worse.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's so amazing about it. You know, Pat Buchanan's positions are, you know, 2 degrees off the mainstream or 3 degrees off the mainstream, and he got virtually no votes. I mean, consistently, he 25-30% of his own party. Al Sharpton is wildly out of the mainstream. He openly uses racial epithets, and he has a legitimate chance of winning the South Carolina presidential primary, which is the first Democratic primary. Iowa's the first caucus. Then they skip New Hampshire. And they go to South Carolina, where 46 or 47% of the likely primary voters in the Democratic primary are black.
So you're hoping he runs because they'll siphon?
No, he's going to run.
He'll be controversial.
I want him to win.
Win, exactly.
He's going to run. He's already, I want him to win because he's the best proof of the premise of Redneck Nation.
Well, are Republicans allowed to vote in South Carolina in the Democratic primary?
Open primary.
Awesome.
You just can't vote in both.
Okay.
That's all. So, well, obviously, there won't be a Republican primary of any significance.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Pat's running again. So George W. Bush will probably not have a primary opponent, which means that every Republican will be able to cross the street and vote for, run, Al, run, baby, run. Man, I'm so excited. I'm having so much fun. If you don't take it so seriously and you're willing to laugh, America's the greatest place to live. My hero, H.L. Mencken, you know, was notorious for anti-American. He was a comedy writer, and he was always bashing America. People asked him one time, why do you live in America? You're always picking on us. You're always making fun of us. Why do you live in America? And he said, why do people go to zoos? It's the best show to watch. You want to see what these crazy folks and the wild beasts are up to. The American people, particularly the dopey, you know, ones that are voting Al Sharpton and watching, you know, Survivor 9 and whatever, they are cracking me up. I am having just way too much fun.
Michael, thank you very much for being on
the
book show. This is Michael Graham, author of Redneck Nation, How the South Really Won the War. Find it at your local bookstore or online.
Do you like to write? If so, Writer's Digest, the world's leading magazine for writers, is for you. Since 1920, Writer's Digest has provided expert writing instruction, inspiration, and up-to-date marketing information. Each month, readers turn to Writer's Digest to discover technique columns geared toward specific genres, including screenwriting, fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and more. Publishing information, including how to write solid cover and query letters that catch the interest of agents and editors. Tips and tricks for overcoming writer's block. Career opportunities. Interviews with best-selling authors. Tools of the trade, including the latest information on writing software and hardware, legal advice for writers, and more. Log on to www.writersdigest.com/thebookshow and ask for your 2 free issues. You'll see why more than 200,000 writers rely on Writer's Digest every month to learn the secrets of getting their words polished, published, and paid for.
Do you want thousands of books at your fingertips? If so, go to enovel.com. At enovel.com, you'll find thousands of e-books, print books, and audiobooks to browse and buy. Enovel.com, the world's biggest e-book site, sells books from big-name authors and hot new rising stars. And if you're a promising writer, Enovel might publish your book, too. So go to www.enovel.com to shop for great e-books, print books, and audiobooks, or to publish your own book today.
The world of publishing is changing. More and more authors are self-publishing their work, and why shouldn't they? Self-publishing offers greater creative control and potential for greater financial reward than more traditional methods. That's why we started Self-Publishers Digest, a how-to guide for authors that want to publish their own work successfully. Each month, we feature articles about writing, marketing, and promoting your self-published piece. All of the articles are written by authors who have self-published successfully. If you're interested in learning more about the world of self-publishing or submitting a story, please contact us at info@titanbeach.com. Or, if you're interested in display or classified advertising opportunities with Self-Publishers Digest, please contact Chris Ferguson at cferguson@titanbeach.com. Self-Publishers Digest, the path to self-publishing.